Hello, and welcome to our program, Acute Myeloid Leukemia, Incorporating the Latest Advances into Nursing Practice. I'm Sandy Curtin, Director of Advanced Practice at the University of Arizona Cancer Center and a nurse practitioner. And today I will share insights to help you remain up to date in the advances made in AML. These are my disclosures. And here are the learning objectives. We're going to talk about nursing considerations for patients with AML who are receiving frontline induction and post-remission therapy. We're going to talk about best supportive care or palliative measures for patients with relapse refractory AML to mitigate any adverse events associated with current medications. And we're going to discuss the current landscape of approved therapies for AML, including considerations for dosing, administration, side effect monitoring and management. And last, we'll talk about patient and family education and how this is important in mitigating these risks. So let's first talk about an overview of AML. AML, or acute myelogenous leukemia, is a clonal hematopoietic stem cell cancer within the myeloid continuum of diseases. This originates in hematopoietic progenitor cells, and this group of diseases or disease was first described in 1845 by Rudolf Virchow. This diagnosis is complex. It requires evaluating both peripheral blood and bone marrow. We know that the definition by the World Health Organization in 2008 changed the definition of AML to require at least 20% blasts. Prior to that, 30% blast was the threshold. This is categorized by how the cells look or morphology, and more recently, very specifically looking at cytogenetic and molecular attributes of the disease to better categorize the risk profile. So part of that diagnostic workup that we perform is looking at a history and physical. So the presence of comorbidities. Many of these patients are older adults, some are younger. We're going to do a geriatric or frailty assessment, look at performance status, family history, historic labs, and then looking at any other history of cancer. This becomes very important when we start talking about secondary AML, and we'll talk about that in more detail later. We're going to look at the peripheral blood, and this includes all of the possible reasons someone might have cytopenias, in particular anemia, so iron, B12 folate, for instance, serum erythropoietin levels, and such. Ultimately, there needs to be a tissue diagnosis. So much like we would do a breast biopsy in a breast cancer patient or do a colonoscopy with biopsy in a colon cancer patient, we need a tissue biopsy. And for patients with hematological malignancies, specifically myeloid malignancies, the bone marrow biopsy, aspirate and trephine biopsy are what meet this requirement. So we're going to look for that 20% threshold for blasts. We're going to look for cellularity, which should be 100 minus your age. And depending on the kind of leukemia or whether it's secondary or de novo, we're going to expect different things here. And then we're going to look for the presence of abnormal morphology. So in patients who have treatment-related MDS that has evolved into AML, or MDS that has evolved into AML itself, we're going to probably see the presence of dysplasia. We're going to look at metaphase cytogenetics. So this is basically those 20 metaphases that you see on a standard cytogenetic report, the presence or absence of iron or fibrosis. And then ultimately, we're going to send it for a variety of cytogenetic and molecular testing. This is the 2016 World Health Organization classification, and you can see that this is completely defined by these cytogenetic and molecular attributes. And so this has become very complex. It requires a skilled hematopathologist and skilled clinicians to identify the specific subtype of disease. These are the various genetic subtypes, and I know that the cartoon here is relatively small, and we don't expect you to remember or know all of these, but it's very important to understand that there are several different subcategories in this nomenclature that are related to prognosis, and in some cases, dictate our approach to treatment. So let's first talk about de novo AML. De novo means from the start. So this is AML that just happens, tends to be very abrupt. These are people that a week ago were just fine, and suddenly they become quite ill very quickly, often presenting to the emergency room, and are found to have very high white counts, or also sometimes low platelets and other cell lines like anemia, and are then noted to have AML. So they may have fevers, infections, bruising, bleeding, fatigue, bone pain, and in some cases skin nodules, although that tends to happen later on. We want to look at risk features. Are they a candidate for a bone marrow transplant? Because ultimately that is the only cure for the majority of these patients, or potential cure. We're going to look at physiological age. If they're much older, we're going to be suspicious of an antecedent myeloid malignancy such as MDS. We're going to look at their performance status and frailty. Can they endure intensive induction therapy? And then what kind of comorbidities they have, and then what are those other risk factors. When we look at these cytogenetic and molecular abnormalities, we categorize them into favorable, intermediate, or poor risk. These are the list of favorable and intermediate molecular and cytogenetic abnormalities, and then we have those that are very adverse. And in these patients in particular, these are either associated with likely antecedent myeloid malignancies, or we know that they are likely going to be refractory to standard therapy. So let's talk about secondary AML. This is a non-World Health Organization term, but basically it means that this didn't just happen on its own, that there is a secondary process. So they either have a prior history of a myeloid malignancy, most commonly MDS, CMML, or myeloproliferative neoplasm, or NPN, or they've had prior exposure to antineoplastic therapy, either chemotherapy, targeted therapies in some cases, or radiation therapy. This is considered to be treatment-related AML. And then in this category is AML with myelodysplasia-related changes, or AML-MRC. The risk of developing AML in these cases is variable, and it has to do with the underlying malignancy, the complexity of genetic changes, and the intensity and the type of treatment for the other cancers. They are all associated with genetic abnormalities and instability, and are present in more than 90% of patients with these subtypes of AML. So let's talk about treatment-related AML. We know that this can include either chemotherapy or radiation. We know that it is time sensitive. So we have early onset, so this is within 3 years of the primary therapy for that other malignancy. And we know there are certain drugs associated with secondary or treatment-related AML. Those are the topo II inhibitors, like etoposide, doxorubicin, and other anthracyclines. We know that these are associated with the MML gene, which is the translocation 1123, and these tend to confer an unfavorable prognosis. We also know that there are those patients that have a late onset, so this is very difficult. It's all very difficult, but these are patients that may have been treated 5 or 10 years ago, and they come back and they've developed cytopenias, and you may think it's their primary malignancy, for instance, in the case of a lymphoma, but in fact, they have treatment-related AML. And these are things like Cytoxan, one of the most common drugs that we use, melphalan, or radiation. So we see a number of patients, for instance, that have had pelvic radiation for either gynecological tumors or prostate cancer in this category. And they tend to have chromosome 5, 7 abnormalities, or 17p, all of which are unfavorable. So again, the risk is the underlying myeloid malignancy, the complexity of the genetic changes, and the intensity and type of treatment. These are some of those diagnostic groups that are associated or have that risk of treatment-related AML based on the disease itself and the drugs and or radiation that we use to treat them. So different solid tumors, the lymphoproliferative disorders, such as the lymphomas, rheumatic diseases. We give some of these drugs, such as methotrexate, in people with rheumatoid arthritis, sometimes over many, many years. Multiple myeloma, which is a plasma cell dyscrasia, part of the lymphoproliferative disorders. And then in acute lymphoblastic leukemia, where people may receive treatment for 2 or 3 years. These are the variables that make it difficult to sometimes diagnose this. And so again, it takes us all to be vigilant and aware of what the risk factors are, and then a very skilled hematopathologist to be able to discern sometimes very subtle changes on the bone marrow biopsy and aspirate sample. So we're going to look for prior exposure. We're going to look for other exposures. Are they a smoker, for instance? Have they had a prior history of cancer? Do they have age-related clonal hematopoiesis? So there's a subtype there. And or is there a history of long-term inflammation or immune dysregulation, as is the case in some of our autoimmune disorders? Then we look at AML with myelodysplasia-related changes, or AML-MRC. And this is a very specific subtype. We know that these patients all carry a variable risk of leukemic transformation over the course of their disease. And so we're going to look at MDS, CMML, and myeloproliferative neoplasms specifically. We're going to look for specific dysplasia in one or more cell lines. So in this case, multilineage dysplasia, meaning multiple cell lines, red blood cell, white blood cell, and platelets. If there is greater than 50% in more than two or more cell lines, in the absence of genetic abnormalities, this actually meets the diagnostic criteria for AML-MRC. So again, very important to have a complete review, a good sample, and then complete review of the bone marrow sample to be able to account for whether that 50% exists. And then there are specific cytogenetic and molecular attributes that are listed here that are also part of that diagnostic criteria and the new World Health Organization classification. So key takeaways in this diagnostic process is that this is becoming increasingly complex. We understand that we need a good sample, a bone marrow biopsy and aspirate. Sometimes we don't get a good enough sample and may need to repeat that. So you need to make sure that the person performing the bone marrow biopsy and aspirate understands how to get a good sample, that we have an adequate specimen, and that we ask all of the questions of that sample at the time we collect it. We're going to look at the patient's history. This is critical. And then we're going to evaluate the bone marrow biopsy aspirate sample for the presence of these genetic and cytogenetic abnormalities. So now let's talk about treatment. So we've made the diagnosis, and we're going to talk about treatment, both in the frontline induction therapy and then in post-remission and relapse refractory settings. So really important that in acute myeloid leukemia, regardless of subtype, we generally start treatment immediately. In de novo AML, that happens usually within a matter of days. These patients often present with very high white blood cell counts, a significant number of blasts, and we start treatment right away. In older patients where we suspect they may have an antecedent myeloid malignancy, we may be able to delay this induction for for up to 7 days, and there is a good study that supports this. This allows us to really tailor that therapy for this specific population. Most patients with AML, particularly older adults, will eventually relapse and few are cured. So our question up front is, are they eligible for a hematopoietic stem cell transplant? And do they have available or donors? And we're going to ask that question right away so that we can plan our long-term treatment. Our goal in induction therapy is to suppress that malignant clone. So we want to reduce the number of blasts right away. We need to empty out the marrow so they become pancytopenic. And then hopefully, as that recovers, there will be healthy cells that repopulate the bone marrow. Ultimately, one cycle of treatment, as with any cancer, is not enough, and we are going to need to consolidate those patients. And this can be done in a number of ways, but basically, this is where we're really looking at achieving a depth of response to erase any molecular evidence of disease. We talked about many of those molecular attributes. We want to make sure that those are no longer detectable in these patients. During this process, patients can become very, very sick and often experience febrile neutropenia or other treatment-related toxicities, and so aggressive supportive care is always expected. This is how that looks in a schema. So we're going to start induction therapy. This is usually aggressive chemotherapeutic regimen still today, and the most common of those has been 7+3, less frequently in patients who have impaired cardiac function. We may modify that slightly. And then basically, we're going to check a day 14 marrow. What that's going to answer for us is, did we empty out the marrow? Is there no longer the presence of excess blasts or the absence of cytogenetic abnormalities? We allow that to recover. If they don't meet the criteria for the absence of these blasts, we're going to have to reinduce them. Otherwise, at that recovery point, typically we would do a day 28 marrow, and we're going to answer the question, is what grew back healthy or not? So if that day 28 marrow shows residual disease, we're going to move to salvage therapy. If there's no evidence of disease, then we're going to move to consolidation. For the medically fit patient, these are people that we would expect to be eligible for a bone marrow transplant. We're also going to evaluate for actionable targets. One of the common actionable targets in AML is something called FLT3. And if they are FLT3 positive, we're going to add a FLT3 inhibitor to their induction and to their consolidation. And we know that these are particularly high-risk patients in terms of relapse. We're going to try to move them to transplant as soon as we achieve a molecular remission. If they do not have a FLT3 mutation and they have favorable cytogenetics, there are different regimens that we can consider. And if they have secondary AML, so this is that older population where we suspect that it came from an antecedent myeloid malignancy, we know that standard 7+3 induction therapy really doesn't work. And we're going to look at alternative options such as CPX351 and then plus or minus transplant if they're eligible for that. And some of these patients who initially are quite sick, if we get their disease under control, may actually be eligible for transplant. If they are unfit and they have greater than 30% bone marrow blasts, we're going to really look at a more palliative approach to therapy. So this is somebody who we believe really is not going to be eligible for a transplant up front. And/or if they have multi-lineage dysplasia, so they're in that AML MRC category, we're going to think about possibly hypomethylating agents. And/or if they do improve with time and are improvement in fitness, we can consider some of the other things we discussed in the prior slide. So let's talk about 7+3. I've been doing this for 36 years, and that's just been the mainstay of what we do for a very long time. So not quite 44 years, but almost. In 1973, this is when this regimen was developed, and this is basically 7 days of cytarabine or Ara-C and three days of daunorubicin. So thus the 7+3. We know that this doesn't work very well in a subset of patients, particularly those patients with secondary AML and or people who are older who may not be able to tolerate this therapy. We know that relapse is inevitable for the majority of these patients, and we have ongoing trials to identify new targets and pathways. There is low intensity treatment. Again, this is palliative. And this can be the hypomethylating agents, either azacitidine or decitabine, as I mentioned, and there are different ways to administer these drugs. We know that low-dose cytarabine offers an option for some of these patients. And then again, we would apply best supportive care, either along with these approaches or as individual therapy in a purely palliative setting. Some of that supportive and palliative care means that we're going to mitigate adverse events and treat those aggressively. We also are going to apply transfusion support, line care, antibiotics, really begin to look at where do they live in proximity to the treatment setting, consider financial burden. And in many cases, we have, you know, very difficult conversations with these patients about the goals of care. So now let's talk about some of the newer therapies that have evolved for AML. Again, we're going to look at first the diagnosis. We're going to look at cytogenetics. Are they favorable or unfavorable? And most of the ones that are unfavorable are associated with these secondary AML, treatment-related AML, and AML-MRC. In that case, we know that those patients do not respond as well to the 7+3 regimen. And we have newer therapies such as the liposomal 7+3 CPX that we talked about earlier. We can use hypomethylating agents here, and we always want to consider clinical trials for these patients. If they have favorable or intermediate cytogenetics, they may be able to have what we call the GO regimen plus or minus 7+3. And then we look at mutational analysis. Do they have any actionable targets? So IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors are available in patients who carry this mutation. We talked about FLT3 previously. And then there are selected other mutations where we know these patients have particularly high-risk disease or perhaps more favorable disease, and we're going to treat them in a different way. So the first thing, let's talk about liposomal daunorubicin and cytarabine, or CPX351. This is a liposomal compound, as we've talked about. These liposomes tend to be taken up better in the bone marrow and linger longer in the bone marrow. This was demonstrated in murine models. And then they undergo degradation, releasing these active compounds of daunorubicin cytarabine directly into the intracellular environment, which is where these abnormal cells reside. This is indicated for adults with newly diagnosed therapy-related acute myeloid leukemia. And you can see how we note that is TAML, or AML with myelodysplasia-related changes, or AML-MRC. This is not your grandmother's 7+3, as we say. This does linger in the marrow, and there are a couple of really key points. Number one is that it is a 5-to-1 molar ratio. The dosing looks different because of the liposomal compound, and we'll go through that in a little bit more detail, but it's not going to be given in the same way as the 7+3. And we may see some differences in bone marrow recovery because of that increased uptake of the liposomal compound. We also know that consolidation will look different than the induction of 7+3. So where we do 7+3 in induction and consolidation, you're going to see a day 1, 3, and 5 in the induction. And then you're going to see a days 1 and 3 in the consolidation setting. Even though that administration guideline looks different, the toxicities can be very similar, and we have to apply the same safety considerations, particularly for cardiotoxicity associated with anthracyclines. The cytopenias, as I mentioned, may be prolonged, and so we're going to have to rethink that day 28 marrow, for instance. And then this compound still carries that risk of extravasation because of the daunorubicin. The common adverse events are very similar to the standard 7+3, so all of those things associated with pancytopenia. Mucositis, diarrhea, musculoskeletal pain can be seen, and then we're going to need to look again at that cardiotoxicity. This is the comparison data looking at CPX-351 and 7+3, so you can see they're almost identical, with the exception of the prolonged cytopenias, in particular thrombocytopenia. So when we normally treat AML with 7+3, we expect that marrow to bottom out at day 14, recover at day 28. When we're applying CPX-351, we need to really rethink that because that may not be what happens at day 28. And we don't want to panic and think that, either they haven't responded or they're not recovering. We need to give it a little bit more time. So you can see here that this prolonged cytopenia was not uncommon in the patients receiving this liposomal compound. So now let's talk about other approaches to therapy. This is FLT3 in AML. So FLT3 is a type 3 transmembrane receptor tyrosine kinase, or a protein. This is in the same family as KIT and PDGFR, alpha and beta. It turns out that these are highly expressed on hematopoietic progenitor cells, which is where the AML cells originate, as we discussed earlier, and that mutations in this FLT3 gene are constitutively activated on the receptor, and that basically makes the cells behave badly and not listen to feedback mechanisms. So it turns out we have a number of small molecule oral agents that can target FLT3. Some of them are very specific, more specific to FLT3. Many of them have off-target effects, and this will have to do with what we see in their toxicity profiles. The first drug approved was midostaurin. So this is indicated for newly diagnosed AML that has this FLT3 mutation, and this is based on FDA-approved tests. This is given as an oral agent, 50 milligrams twice daily with food, and it's given days 8 through 21, so 14 days of treatment, but waiting a week after their standard induction therapy. It can be also added to consolidation, and there is some research looking at maintenance therapy. This can add to nausea and vomiting, so we need to make sure that they have antiemetics available and want to hold it for any pneumonitis without infectious etiology, as there can be some cases of pulmonary toxicity. Other warnings and precautions are embryo-fetal toxicity. This is true of most things we use for AML. And then I mentioned the pulmonary toxicity. It is an oral compound, and so we do need to be aware of CYP3A inhibitors, the most common of these being antifungal agents, which are commonly applied to patients with AML because they are cytopenic, sometimes for prolonged periods of time. So we talked about the common adverse events. The second compound is gilteritinib, and this is indicated for the treatment of adult patients who have relapsed or are refractory AML and with a FLT3 mutation. The dosing here is 120 milligrams once daily, with or without food. These come in 40 milligram tablets. And the most common adverse events are transaminase increase, bone and muscle pain, fatigue, again, things that are associated with cytopenias because these are people with AML who have also undergone either induction or consolidation therapy. And then we can see some renal impairment and GI toxicity. Also, very rarely, you can see posterior reversible encephalopathy or PRES syndrome, and in the presence of that, you would discontinue this drug completely. You can also see prolonged QT intervals, and so we're going to be monitoring these patients with baseline EKGs and periodic EKGs for anybody who is symptomatic. We're also going to correct hypokalemia and hypomagnesemia to reduce the possibility of QT prolongation. Cases of pancreatitis were reported in the studies, and so we do need to monitor for that, which requires amylase and lipase monitoring. And then again, embryo-fetal toxicity is a consideration. So now let's talk about some of the other targeted therapies. These are what we are looking at is IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors. And so mutations in either IDH1 or IDH2 are observed in approximately 12% of patients with AML. And this takes us back to the Krebs cycle way back when, which most of us don't want to revisit. But there are elements of that that obviously have to do with cellular development and differentiation. And so these compounds can offer a good treatment option for those patients that carry those mutations, again, actionable targets. The first of these drugs is enasidenib. This is an IDH2 inhibitor, and this acts by inducing bone marrow differentiation and maturation rather than ablation. So the presence of these mutations basically inhibit the normal development of these cells, and by giving these inhibitors, you can overcome that and reinduce differentiation and maturation. This is indicated for adults with relapsed and refractory AML. Again, they have to have documented IDH2 mutations. And the dosing here is 100 milligrams once daily. This is given basically until progression or unacceptable toxicity. It can take a long time to see benefits. So unlike induction therapy, where we are going to look for 14 days and no evidence of blasts, this may actually take several weeks or months to see the full benefit of patients. The continuous daily dosing is generally well tolerated and can induce hematological responses in patients with prior AML therapy. And I have a few patients that I have seen who have done very well on these compounds. There are no significant interactions with food, antacids, or other agents, but there are warnings and precautions. You can see tumor lysis syndrome or tumor lysis-like syndrome. Again, this is a differentiation process. So as those cells are dividing and differentiating, you can be breaking down cells as well, which is the characteristic of tumor lysis. There is a very specific differentiation syndrome that can be seen. We've seen this historically in acute promyelocytic leukemia, where we also use differentiation agents. And so it's very important to familiarize yourself with that, and we'll talk about it briefly a little bit later. You can see initial leukocytosis. Again, these cells are being induced back into differentiation and maturation, so you can see an initial spike, and it's very important to discriminate that from progression of disease. You can also see some elevated bilirubin. That also comes from this differentiation process, primarily from red blood cells. Some of the adverse events, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, are the most common. And then grade 3-4 adverse events, again, we talked about tumor lysis syndrome, differentiation syndrome, and leukocytosis. Then the IDH1 inhibitor, ivosidenib, acts also by inducing bone marrow differentiation and maturation rather than ablation on a different target. So they're all in that and that same general pathway, but different components of it. This is indicated for the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia with a susceptible IDH1 mutation, again, needing to achieve that through an FDA-approved test. And this is for adults with newly diagnosed AML who are over the age of 65 or have comorbidities that preclude intensive induction therapy, or with patients that have relapsed or refractory AML. Dosing is 500 milligrams once daily with or without food, again, until disease progression or unacceptable toxicity. And it's important to understand when we're using these kinds of agents, if there's an aberrant pathway with a mutation, In the absence of a hematopoietic stem cell transplant, specifically an allogeneic stem cell transplant, that aberrant pathway will persist. And if we remove these drugs that are targeting these actionable targets, that aberrant pathway will resume and you'll begin to see that abnormal function again. So that is the rationale behind until disease progression or unacceptable toxicity. Want to avoid taking this with a high fat meal. And then warnings and precautions, you can see QT prolongation, rarely Guillain-Barré syndrome. So this is similar to the Prez syndrome that we talked about previously, but very important to do these neurological assessments for patients. And if any of these signs and symptoms are present, you need to do a complete workup, including an MRI of the brain, and discontinue therapy. Other adverse events, very similar to what we've discussed with the other IDH inhibitor. And then laboratory abnormalities can be seen that indicate either the presence of tumor lysis or LFT elevation. Here's the differentiation syndrome. There was a review committee that basically identified the key features of this, and it's very important to familiarize yourself with the signs and symptoms for these patients. If you're treating somebody on here, if in doubt, we give steroids. This is the empiric therapy to overcome that process. It's important to understand that there are other things that can mimic this process, particularly infectious etiologies that may cause similar pulmonary symptoms, which is the primary concern here. These patients can also have a very rapid weight gain and fluid symptoms of fluid overload, including pleural effusions and pericardial effusions. So we want to watch these patients very, very carefully. You can see less commonly DIC, but that is something, if they're having bleeding or bruising, we're going to want to evaluate. In IDH associated differentiation, IDH inhibition differentiation syndrome, 11.7% of study participants basically showed that this was likely the cause. So there are a lot of other reasons people may have these symptoms. Very important to understand that, because if this is not truly differentiation syndrome, we want to continue to give them their IDH inhibitor therapy. So very important to understand this phenomena, get the appropriate diagnosis, provide aggressive supportive care, and understand if this is truly the case, can they continue their IDH inhibition therapy with concurrent steroids. The other thing that's really important is those steroids need to be continued until this is completely resolved. So you don't want to give just a burst of steroids and then abruptly stop, because if this is differentiation syndrome, those cells are already in that process, and it may take a while for this to resolve. So very important to look at the duration of steroid therapy. Then we talked about the GO regimen, or gemtuzumab ozogamycin. This is a drug that we used years ago, and then it was taken off the market for a period of time because we didn't really understand the adverse event profile. So this is an anti-CD33 monoclonal antibody. It's a conjugate, so it's conjugated with calicheamycin, which is sort of the carrier molecule, if you will. And this is indicated for patients with newly diagnosed CD33 positive AML, either in the relapsed refractory setting or in the newly diagnosed population. It's also approved for pediatric patients 2 years and older. These patients, it's monoclonal antibody, so all of the principles of monoclonal antibodies apply, so pre-medication to avoid hypersensitivity reactions. And you can see the dosing here for induction and consolidation, and some difference in the regimens that we use for newly diagnosed and relapsed refractory patients. It also has warnings and precautions. One of the big things that we saw in the early clinical trials was hepatotoxicity, and particular people who had had a previous bone marrow transplant, they may have developed veno-occlusive disease, and so hepatic failure can be seen. So very important to know what was their prior therapy and have they had a prior allogeneic stem cell transplant. We talked about hypersensitivity reactions. This is a monoclonal antibody. And in some patients, hemorrhage was seen, including fatal hemorrhage. And so, as with any patient with AML who develops thrombocytopenia or has a risk of developing DIC, we need to pay particular attention to bleeding risk. Other than that, we talked about LFT elevation and hepatotoxicity, but you can also see a rash, fever, nausea, and vomiting. The next group of drugs are BCL-2 inhibitors in AML. This is a very recent development, specifically here, venetoclax. We know that BCL-2 plays a role in hematopoietic development and that the overexpression of BCL-2 is associated with apoptosis or programmed cell death. And so this is BCL-2 is in the mitochondria of the cell. It happens to be overexpressed in AML. And so it makes sense that these cells are primed for BCL-2 inhibition. Venetoclax is an oral compound. We've used this in a number of other hematopoietic malignancies, but this is approved in combination with a hypomethylating agent, either azacitidine or decitabine or low-dose cytarabine for either newly diagnosed patients with AML over the age of 75 who are not eligible for induction therapy or stem cell transplant. This ramp-up dosing is very different than the ramp-up dosing we use for our lymphoid malignancies where we use this compound. So you basically are going to do day one, two, three by an incremental increase from 100, 200 to 400, which is the final dosing. There is indication for a 600 milligram dosing when used with low-dose cytarabine. Very important that there are significant drug-drug interactions, again, particularly with antifungal agents that may be commonly used with AML patients. And so we need to really rethink what we're doing. If we're not using a purine analog like high-dose Ara-C or 7+3, we're going to have to really figure out, do we really need to have an antifungal drug on hand? If that's necessary, then you would not ramp up to these higher doses because the compound becomes too toxic and people develop severe cytopenias. Some of the other toxicities associated with venetoclax include GI toxicities. You, again, can see a rash. You may see bone pain. And then other things that are common in these patients who may develop infections. Warnings and precautions, again, tumor lysis syndrome, particularly in anybody that has a high blast count or a high white blood cell count. Most of the time, patients with MDS with MDS or AML-MRC, people that have antecedent myeloid malignancies, most of those patients actually present with cytopenias, and this is less of a concern, but it's not a risk of zero. So you need to assess those patients carefully. Again, cytopenias may be significant in these patients, and dose modification may be required. They're going to be at increased risk for infections because we're suppressing BCL-2, which also has to do with the normal development of B lymphocytes, which provide us humoral immunity. This can have teratogenicity associated with it, so embryo fetal risk, and we're going to have to counsel patients on that. So key points for current and future practice then. Really, we have to be very specific in the diagnostic process so that we can risk stratify patients and really choose the best therapy based on their individual disease characteristics. We want to be sure that we access drugs in a timely manner. And again, we saw a variety of dosing regimens that can be used. Some of these are oral compounds. Many remain injectable drugs. If we can, we need to try to do outpatient management as much as possible, but there are very specific criteria that need to be met for outpatient management of these patients. Always, one of our goals is to preserve future treatment options, and we do this by managing comorbidities. So, for instance, if we're giving them an anthracycline-containing regimen, we're going to want to make sure that we're monitoring ejection fraction and the presence of any cardiotoxicity. Similarly, if there are hepatotoxicity or renal toxicity associated with treatment, we need to carefully monitor this so that this does not exclude them from having drugs that are hepatically cleared through hepatic or renal pathways. The adverse events, some of these are things we've known for a long time. Those of you that have been in practice a long time may be familiar with some of these toxicities, such as differentiation syndrome, for instance, from other compounds. And we need to reapply those principles to the current therapy. Time to best response. We talked about the liposomal compound, CPX351, where that day 14 and day 28 paradigm really does not apply. And we need to rethink our expectations for bone marrow recovery so that we're not changing therapy prematurely and we're treating people in the best way possible, given the mechanism of action of the individual drug. And then very specifically, how best to treat the older patients or frail patients with AML, understanding that many of these people have antecedent myeloid malignancies and standard approaches to therapy like 7+3 are not likely to provide benefit. So where do we go from here? There are a number of emerging therapies. All of these are based on ongoing clinical trials. There are some novel targets being explored, like smoothened or SMO, for instance, the RAS-RAF and MAP kinase pathways. There are NET8 inhibitors that are being explored, and then MDM2 inhibition using either some of these newer compounds that are in clinical trials. So we always want to consider a clinical trial for patients. This is how we've come to have all of the drugs that are currently available. And so if patients are eligible for a clinical trial, that is always a consideration. Thank you for joining me for this presentation. I hope this information will be useful to you in the care of your patients.